Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Brian O'Leary. He's, I guess, a well-known figure in publishing. He's a consultant, operates a business called Magellan Media and blogs intelligently, I would say. How are you, Brian?
I'm doing really well. Thanks. Those are very kind things of you to say.
Well, they're all true, so it's not a problem to say them. You know, and I like to give the website address for the people that I'm talking to. Yours is a little long, longer than most. But that's all right. Magellan, which, if in case people don't know how to spell it, is Magellan, mediapartners.com. And I want to recommend a particular piece, which is why what prompted me to want to talk to you, which is a piece you wrote called The Opportunity in Abundance. And maybe you can give a little background on it, and then we can, you know, I can ask you some questions about it. Just for people who are looking it up, this was posted October 31st. So if you know, you're looking at this sometime in the future, you'll have to go back into the archives at Magellan Media to find it.
Yeah, especially if I'm prolific, which I hope to be. Opportunity in Abundance actually grew out of a presentation that I gave also at Books and Browsers in 2010 that I called Context First. That was really an effort to look at what publishers, individual publishers or content producers, could do to compete in a world of essentially content abundant and probably lower price competition. The focus there was really that workflows within publishing houses or any content producers would have to change to effectively capture a lot more information about the content early on, because it was going to be critical to both discovery and access and utility of the content in the future, both in the near future as well as the long-term monetization of that content. So I started thinking about that sort of same question of what happens to the publishing business as content becomes really abundant, and the models that we have in place where, in effect, scarcity is kind of what we've created. You know, there's only so many books in the universe. There are only so many houses that are working. That a lot of that is breaking apart. We feel it every day. You know, I mean, the second half of 2011 has been, if anything, a wake-up call for not just the book business, but for any content producers and how many different players are in the marketplace, how many different offerings, and also how the supply chain has been evolving right before our eyes.
And where I think you could say, I don't want to interrupt you from your flow, but it's, you know, people in different industries are observing the breakdown of the notion of what I would call authority, which is the idea that there are stars, there are people, there are writers in the canon that everyone accepts as the great writers. When you have abundance, it's much more rich than that, than a narrow group of individuals who are create or who are kind of identified and constructed as the books you must find, which is a kind of a corollary of scarcity.
It is, you know, and that's an important point, and not one that I drew out as much. That was a little bit more in Context First than it is in Abundance. But it's a critically important point. One, I think that Richard Nash, who I'm sure you've had a chance to talk to in the past, has said it with respect to his development of Cursor, is that he wanted to break through the kind of false scarcity model that tended to favor books that appealed to I'm not quite presenting this as his view, but in effect, well-educated white men, and then their perception of what various audiences might want, and instead to say that there's a panoply of voices out there. We can support many of them, maybe even all of them, but we can't support them using the same model we've had in the past. That was kind of what motivated him to try Cursor, and it also in some ways motivated me to think about what happens as we content becomes a lot more abundant. And I had said four things with respect to Context First that I think are still true. One was favoring open, accessible, and interoperable content. A second was that, you know, focusing on the use of context to promote discovery, which is going to become harder as, you know, in the situation that you alluded to a moment ago. The third was to try and remind publishers that trying to compete on the cost of content when you're up against folks who have none of the overhead you know, using low or no cost tools, trying to compete on the cost of content is probably not the right way to go. And that ultimately we may need to provide readers with tools that help them effectively draw upon the context that we provide to manage abundance, to help make content more discoverable, more manageable, and more useful to them.
Now, when you say we, I just want to make sure that it's clear. You're talking about publishers in that we.
I am, yeah. And I think I might have a broader definition of publishers over time, but I was really trying to appeal to maybe what we would say, quote-unquote, traditional publishers, ones that were widely recognized, not just obviously the Big Six or even just trade publishers, but the $40 billion U.S. industry. That was kind of what I was focused on. And part of it, honestly, is, I mean, that's the market, A, that I know and that I sell to, but B, that, you know, because I'm working in it, I have the most familiarity. But I think there'll be a lot of changes over time where new entrants will come in. I don't have my arms around them just yet. I think I can stipulate that they're going to be here. But when I talk about we, I'm really thinking about the folks who are currently participating in that $40 billion market.
Right. And in the sense of trying to help them understand what the new environment is.
Yep.
Because I think there's a lot of it. I think you probably... I'm sure this is fairly clearly observable that people are constantly trying to figure out what is going to happen, how things are going to unfold, because they're trying to recreate their businesses around new priorities and new realities that exist for them in terms of how customers are behaving, not to mention the competition, which is now, as you indicate, in abundance.
Yeah, both the competition and as well, there's an evolution of the supply chain where some of the folks that used to be, in effect, customers or intermediaries are now competitors. I mean, Amazon's an easy example, but, you know, lots of people are getting into lots of aspects of what you might consider traditional publishers to have done in the past, and I don't think that's going to go away. So the thing that actually got me thinking about abundance, the presentation that I gave in October, started at South by Southwest. I was sitting listening to Seth Priebeck talk about game design and principles of game design. This is around the same time that Jane McGonigal had published her book, and Reality is Broken. And I started to wonder, because I'd studied game theory, which is obviously somewhat different from game design, but I'd studied game theory in business school, and I thought, well, I wonder if there's some aspect of game design and game theory that might converge to help us think about what publishers and the industry can do to try and work through this current situation. And I came up with a couple of ideas that I'm sure we'll talk about. But it started really with work that Howard Rafa had done in the 1950s to the mid-1980s, both at Harvard, at the Kennedy School, as well as at the business school. And it was just an interesting way to start to look at it, because he defined things in terms of essentially two-party, one-issue negotiations, which tend to be win-lose. You know, the one party gets the better of the other. Many party, one issue negotiations, which again tend to be a little bit less win lose because there's sometimes more perspectives and more trade offs on those on that one issue. But then there's the interesting situation of many parties, many issues. And I started to wonder if the supply chain that we currently have, which is kind of built for a static environment, you know, where the terms of trade are well understood, the size of the market is clear. The trends in growth and shifting in product mix are not great, none of which are true anymore. I wondered if trying to continue to do a two-party, one-issues negotiations in series, you know, for things like discount rates and terms and royalty rates and the like, might actually be making matters worse.
So, but let me ask you one question about that, because in a sense, the negotiation over price and terms is two-party, one issue. But in another way, all of that exists in a context, both historical, so I would say, you know, vertical and horizontal, because, you know, there's any one publisher that tries to modify those terms is doing so in a context where others are doing it differently.
Yeah, I think that the... that's kind of the many parties one issue play out. I mean, you work in a soup, so that if, not picking on Random House per se, but if Random House negotiates and decides to not negotiate an agreement with Apple in early 2010, it affects how Random House thinks about it, but it also affects to a certain extent what Latitude and what thinking the other players, the other big five players that did sign with Apple for agency have in that marketplace. And there's always this interplay within the various both significant and smaller participants in the market. I think the thing, though, that we lose sight of, and this is ultimately what brought me both back to game theory and game design, is that we're losing sight of the purpose that we want to serve, because we're kind of still negotiating as if, by and large, we can set terms and price and control supply, none of which are really demonstrably true anymore, in a way that is sustainable over time. I think what's happening, in fact, is that we're becoming less relevant rather than more, again, we being the traditional publishing industry. And we're losing traction at a time when we should be actually trying to cast a much wider net and say, what is it we're trying to accomplish? One of the things that Howard Rayford dug up, and he used one of the examples they use in abundance is the Law of the Sea, the international treaty negotiations for mining seabeds that are not specifically in certain national territories, which is the vast parts of the ocean. He said that essentially you have to agree on purpose and a certain degree of fairness. Those are the things that make a big difference. That's not really the way that we're going about reforming the supply chain or the industry overall. So what I proposed in my presentation was that we try to reposition publishing, really, as essentially content creation, management, and distribution, as the engine of the engagement economy. That we're the thing that drives effective conversations at all sorts of different levels and in all sorts of different sectors or niches. And then from there, say, okay, if that were our goal and put together the players in the industry, how could we achieve that? And I think that starts to reframe a lot of thinking about things like royalty rates, terms of trade, formats, even copyright. Because if our goal is to be effective and to make money off that, it's very different from simply saying, all right, this is the fundamental belief in a lot of negotiations now, is it's a zero-sum game. Anything I get, you don't. Or anything you get, I don't. But if you think of it in terms of influence in the engagement part of the economy, in effect, there's a tremendous amount of opportunity because people are reading and consuming information at a greater rate and in a greater volume than has ever been the case before. It's just we don't have a business model for it.
Yeah, I would say that's true. I think that the simplified way of saying that is that we're not used to an economy which is not driven by a kind of price, a price material relationship. That in fact, what I've been thinking of it as is an attention economy. That what we, people are. If you are competing, you're not competing for dollars, you're competing for eyeballs and time, because time is finite. And the only way to increase the amount of time is to increase the number of people that are engaged in what you're doing. And that's something.
I think that's true. And I think this is not something I talk about in any degree in the presentation, but I served 9 years on a public school board, and I had 3 years in particular where the local reporter, a woman named Maria Zingaro, just not just out of college, but relatively young, was actively involved in framing issues in a way that made them intelligible to the community. Her predecessors had generally been younger. Her successors were also pretty young. And not particularly experienced at beat reporting at a municipal or school board level. And so quite often the reporting was jumbled, mangled, or non-existent. It takes a while to become a good reporter, a good journalist. She had a lot of that skill naturally. And I'll say that those middle 3 years of my time on the school board were not controversy-free. but they were so much better informed. And when people came, their issues were actionable. Because they would say, I have a concern with this, and it would be informed by reporting and coverage that was accurate. We have a, you know, ultimately, I think, publishing, and I think this is broader than book publishing, obviously, but books play a role, has a responsibility for creating this sort of social good, this understanding in the country that doesn't exist today. And we've kind of abdicated it, but I don't think it's because bad reporting or bad coverage or bad media draws out good, but because there isn't nearly enough good media there. And when it does exist, I think people flock to it, and it has a major effect on how people think about the world around them, whether it's domestic or local or international.
No, I think that's true. I think that you know, that's sort of in the context of kind of contemporary politics. I think the idea of the public good seems, you know, has been driven out over the last 40 or maybe 100 years. That it's, you know, it's almost a feature of the what you might consider the industrial or the post-industrial revolution.
That I think that's true. And it's I lament that, because that's not the business I wanted to come into, and it is the business that I'd love to restore. Part of it, if I could speak plainly, is that I think that publishers declare that they have this special role, this sacred trust, this unique understanding of culture, but then we don't deliver on it. We under-deliver on it, and so with all due respect to brilliant ideas for marketing, go the F to sleep doesn't really do it for me. You know, I know that we're all excited because it's an interest, and I more than anyone should be excited that, you know, a viral PDF pirated by its own creators managed to sell content. So we learned something from that. But there's a whole world of opportunity out there that could be much more effective and much more involved. I also think that ultimately, if you set a big, hairy goal, and I think trying to become the engine of this new economy is a big, hairy goal, then you start to think about things differently. You know, you don't think about things simply in terms of how many units are you going to ship, or what the first 10,000 units royalty rate is. You really think about, well, if we're in the marketplace and this is really making a difference, what other ways could we get in front of people? You know, if folks really have a hankering for information, you know, will they pay for it? And if they will pay for it, how can we be there for them? And can we use technology? And I don't have this all worked out. You know, the thing you alluded to a few minutes ago about the predictions of the future of publishing, I don't make any, because I have no idea what the future of publishing is. I only have an idea of what the future of publishing should mean for us if we're successful.
Well, no, but I think it's better to have a vision than it is to respond to the day to day kind of the mundane day to day. But I also think what you just suggested, it kind of reminds me a little bit of thinking about the beginning of the computer, what people call the computer revolution. That you know, if you think about and again, it's Apple comes to mind, but it wasn't just Apple. There were hundreds and hundreds of companies and thousands of people who were thinking about the future and the way that they could harness technology for the greater good. And that happened to be a way for them to make businesses happen. But really what motivated them in many cases was this incredible, powerful vision of the possibilities that new technology would enable. That, you know, when people started talking about the World Wide Web, it was about a democratization based on open communication and information being available widely. And I think that really got a lot of people excited. There are books about that whole period that have been coming out now that really focus on the motivations of the people that were part of that revolution. And I think what you're suggesting is to create a revolution like that, a kind of a forward-thinking, positivist view of the future based on what you could do that would be good for people. And it doesn't mean you're telling them what the content of your books or the books will be or what they should read. It has nothing to do with content. It has to do with availability.
Yeah, availability and a presentation of that availability in a way that makes it useful and appealing to the people that you want to change. You know, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants here. You know, Michael Hart, who founded Project Gutenberg 40 years ago this year, and passed away this fall, or actually in early September, is really the harbinger. I mean, he talked about abundance from the day he started to do this. He completely understood how it would play out. And one of the things that really motivated me to both build on his ideas and include them in the presentation on abundance was an exchange I read in which he predicted that a reading-enabled future, one in which we truly were the engine of the engagement economy, would see book prices plummet, which doesn't make publishers happy as necessarily, literacy and education rates soar, and then power structures that are currently in place crumble in the wake of what he saw as scientific, industrial, and humanitarian revolutions. Now, it's hard to sell revolution as a consultant, and it's a bit unnerving. You know, the way I describe it in the speech, it's cool if you're part of the proletariat, but it might be a bit unnerving if you're an oligarch or you're aspiring to be one. And so what I was trying to do in proposing this different approach was to say that how do we reform the supply chain to start to make these things possible without necessarily blowing up everything that we have? Because it's just, you know, revolution is disruptive and disorienting, and we might lose a lot before we gain something. I'm more interested in saying, at least in the near term, what could we do differently? And so I started to talk in the presentation about the supply chain and the differences between complicated, where you can sort of specify the inputs and know what the outputs are, and complex. And I think that what we currently have is a complex supply chain where you can specify all the inputs, but there's so many other things going on that the results are no longer nearly as predictable as they once were. And at that point, that suggests that we need to start changing some of the rules for how we negotiate and how we think about the supply chain overall.
So do you think that the implication of your thinking, and there's a lot here, I think we're not going to be able to summarize everything you've written about here, but do you think that there is the implication of this piece is that there should be conversation, more formally conversation than just talk, but some kind of communication on a high level between the companies that are and people who are drive, you know, who are kind of in, I don't want to say in charge, but in a position to make change on a large scale?
Yeah, and there are antitrust constraints, obviously, that need to be respected. And I'm not suggesting we just throw turn the whole thing over. I invoked actually an example that I had direct experience with from the early 1980s, the Gas Research Institute, which was put together in 1976, at a time, if you recall, when the first and second energy shocks had occurred. And the natural gas industry at the time was highly fragmented among producers, wholesalers, and distributors, so it sounds kind of familiar. And the distributors kind of had monopolies, at least local, very local monopolies. And what they wound up doing is putting in essentially a small surcharge on every unit of gas, natural gas sold in the United States. And they collected that money. By 1981, which is the fifth year after the act and only the fourth year of money spent at the Gas Research Institute, they were spending $68.5 million on research and a total of $80.5 million on the total budget, oversight and R&D combined. And the industry at that point was about a $38 billion industry. So there's no way in tarnation that if you took all the efforts that are currently going on at the Office Guild, the AAP, the BISG, the NISO, name your association or similar quasi-research association, that they're spending anything even close to $68 million on research. And as a result, we have this industry that has very little data about what drives reading, what drives engagement, how reading occurs, what the role of libraries are. might be and are today, et cetera. And, you know, and then we're making these giant decisions, you know, for example, about Amazon and its library initiative, to say, well, you know, we're going to cut off libraries. Well, if that's the source of 2/3 of your new readers, I'm making that number up, obviously. But if you found out that 2/3 of your new readers came from public libraries, and you just killed them, you just killed yourself, too. And so we have none of the data that we need. And this goes back to the first time you and I spoke, and we talked a little bit about piracy. I'm not for or against piracy as an activity. I'm actually against pirating content. But I'm for understanding what the impact of piracy is before I start to try and kill it. And I feel very much that we don't have that. We don't have that funding right now. We don't have that research right now. And so we're making decisions in a very blind way. So I suggested two things. One was, yes, open up the conversation the way you described. But the other is look at creating a superstructure, you know, and start to challenge yourself. This is in a subsequent post, but I looked at the, you know, I just asked questions like, why do we have a book industry study group and the IDPF, which is kind of the digital version of the book industry study group? And part of the reason is that there's history there, and BISG moved relatively slowly around digital. But funding two organizations for a supply chain that's essentially merging through a mixture of physical and digital that you can never really predict, you want to have those two things working together. And arm's length conversations twice a year, while helpful, aren't enough to get us there. So I'd say we have to revamp the structure of the industry and really spend, if we're currently spending $68 million, we're spending it badly. My guess is that we're not spending it at all.
Right. No, I think the complaint that most, that anybody looking at the publishing industry would say is that there is far too little research, and that it, this is not a knock on BISG, but that you would need, there's so many issues that we have no understanding of. I have no idea what it would cost to study what we need to study, but it clearly, I don't think it's possible that it can be done by any individual company, no matter how many resources they bring to bear on it. It has to be something that crosses over.
I mean, when you look at BISG, its annual budget is well below $1 million. And I mean, and that fundamentally covers staff. They spend some money on research, and you're right, this isn't a knock against BISG. That's just not adequate. When I look at the money that the Authors Guild, the AAP, and others spent on the Google lawsuit, I'm thinking, you know, I understand why you have to defend your members' interests, and member-based organizations, naturally, that's the way they work. I consult with a fair number of associations, and I respect that they have to be advocates for the people that they represent, and that are paid money to produce. But it's not getting you, it's not, that's essentially a two-party, one-issue negotiation. That's not moving you ahead. That's not making you more prepared to deal with a content-abundant universe. It's simply trying to preserve the old order for a little bit longer. And I think that I understand why that happens, and maybe sometimes it has to happen. Man, when you spend millions of dollars on that and you don't know what the role of libraries is, that worries me.
No, I think that, well, we, and similarly, if you think about reading, just understanding where reading is happening, how much reading is going on, you know, we have, I tried to look at that a couple of years ago. You really only have the, most recently, the National Endowment for the Arts study, which was a very narrow and small study. It, you know, there's just not enough information to really know how reading occurs and when, you know, it clearly, well, so I guess the question is, does this mean that you are going to knock on doors and try to get this to happen, or are you just throw, I mean, and I, are you, you know, I know you're busy, so you might not be able to do that, but are you throwing this out as a challenge to the industry and hoping that somebody will step forward?
Well, I think I have to go beyond hoping, but I don't intend to knock on doors. I think going to, at least not at first, what I've been working on is a series of posts to explain what the recommendations that I've made might look like. You know, how would you do multi-party negotiations, for example, if you're a publisher, if you're an author? What would they bring? What would you want them to bring to the table? How would you want them to think about it? What rules would they make, what would make sense for them to think about what would they be willing to put on the table from my own perspective. And it's not, I'm obviously not giving them strategy, but to try and make it more real and to take the theory that's evident in abundance and then turn it into something more specific, at least for the major supply chain participants. And the second thing I think, and I've had some support from this, it's very informal and I don't want to oversell it. It's a couple of folks who I think could be influential and, you know, haven't really said, you know, put my name on it. I've said, we want to get beyond you on this. We'd love to have, you know, but I think I need to give them something to hang their hats on. And if they wind up taking the lead, I think that would be better because, you know, I'm a consultant. I'm one guy. I have an idea. I like my idea. It's why I have it. But, you know, I think that there are better people in the industry to lead, people with greater voices and more influence. And if I can help them, you know, get over the hump and start to do that, that's great. At least one of the organizations that, one of the people I was talking to is an organization that might be in a position to fund it, at least at some. And there are already some very good, interesting things going on in the foundation area where they're funding, for example, in the scholarly space to try and develop new business models. I think that that's not unusual in that space. It just doesn't exist on a broad basis for publishing as a whole. So, again, I'm trying to integrate a number of things that are occurring in different parts of publishing, as well as in game design and elsewhere. But these aren't world-beating ideas. It's just I'm trying to find enough of a critical mass that people will actually buy into them.
Well, I think I think the piece you wrote is really challenging, and I think makes the reader think about a lot of ideas that we have maybe half formed or thought of at one time or another. But you give them, I think, a certain cohesiveness and organization that then leads to a conclusion, which I think is a useful endeavor. You know, the idea that, you know, from this article you might, or this essay and this series of essays you've done, maybe some action will occur. I think that would be a pretty substantial accomplishment.
Well, it's, you know, I think that ultimately it's, if we can reduce the barriers for that naturally are in place for people in different for-profit and not-for-profit association and trade groups to come together and just talk, then that's a good thing. I think that it's, I've heard informally that there have been discussions in the wake of both what I said of books and browsers and some other stuff that I've written since then. And I think that's encouraging, but I just need to kind of continue to either prime the pump or you know, try and move this along by writing about it and talking about it. I found when I did the piracy research, I did the door-to-door work for the better part of a year. It's hard for any one organization to get there, and I think particularly when you're looking at a one-off consultancy, it's not as if I'm McKinsey coming down the pike and able to fund something to the tune of, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars to a million, or to put a couple people on it full-time for 3 to 6 months. You know, you're borrowing time from everybody else. And as a result, I really didn't get to any critical mass. I got no funding whatsoever on piracy other than the royalties that came out, a small amount of royalties that came out of a research report that I wrote with O'Reilly's data. But, you know, you go in, I went in probably, I don't know what the right multiple is, but 20 times or more the amount that I got in royalties is the money invested in that research. No one person can do that. I think entities have to do it. And so I'm not inclined to do that except in a very focused way, and I think I'd rather just work more on the idea first and see what comes out of that.
Well, I hope something will, and I hope if it does, I want to be able to talk about it with you again.
Okay, I'd be happy to.
Thanks, Brian. Well, listen, this has been great talking to you. I want to thank you for spending some time. I've been talking to Brian O'Leary of Magellan Media Partners about specifically about a piece he wrote called The Opportunity in Abundance, but there's a prior piece to it and subsequent pieces to it that you can find at MagellanMediaPartners.com. Thanks so much, Brian.